Hello, and welcome to another episode of For the Love of a Franchise, where we take a stroll back over some of those big moneymakers and not so big moneymakers that Hollywood have produced. Feels like it's been a bit of a while since the last episode.
But it hasn't been that much. We recorded in September, and it's the end of October, so we've not missed anything. We've still got an episode in.
Feels like it. Through holidays and illness and now we've got one with us with jet lag. As you can hear with me are Paul and Josh. Paul's the one with jet lag, you all right, mate?
Yeah, not too bad. I'll get through it. There might be some words misplaced somewhere along the line, but I'll be fine.
I just can't spray his worms correctly today. Oh shit, I'm doing it now.
And also with us for the time being, shall we say, is Josh.
I'm here.
Spoiler for next year. So we're back on track now again with the Omen franchise, and tonight we're looking at Damien Omen 2. And I suppose I shall just jump straight in with one of mine and Paul's favourite topics for these podcasts is time jumps.
Yeah,
it's a jarring one for this one.
Yeah, I find it kind of strange that it starts with him like completely out in the open, that he's acknowledging the fact that this is what he is and he doesn't care.
Because we get a bit of, the film kind of starts almost straight away from the others, about a week or so later, isn't it?
Yeah.
After the death of Gregory Peck's character. Is it Robert? And then we see Liam McKern again, which was pretty cool, I thought.
Yeah.
Although he doesn't last long in this one. is it Bugerhausen? I never quite pronounced his surname. I think that might be right. And Ian Hendry in a sort of cameo as well, which is quite an interesting sort of bit of casting. Then we get that infamous sort of time jump, don't we? It's something we'll probably touch on in the third part as well, in the way that these films sort of squeeze together, and you have to sort of put aside the fact that, like, it's 7 years later, but it only came out like 3 years after the other one.
Yeah.
And it's a similar thing we'll get when we get to part three as well. We've got an adult Sam Neill. I saw this discussed somewhere else, actually, because if you kind of backtrack it from part three when we get to it, it effectively means the first one's set, I think, in the 50s.
That's weird because they physically give his Damien's date of birth as 1976.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just the way they shortcutted it, wasn't it, for making these telling the stories. But it is quite jarring, I think, the first time you see the films.
Well, this is what it'll be for me, because now I know that that's what's going to happen for the third one.
Yeah, well, it's giving you a little bit, because Sam Neill's his character ranked 30, I think, in the third one. You'll see when we get to watching it.
Yeah, that's going to royally piss me off, to be honest.
But yeah, so it's a bit like that sort of Simpsons and Family Guy timeline where everything sort of, where it's ever-changing sort of timeline where the characters never really change.
Yeah,
like
until the Simpsons explained it.
For about 20-odd years.
Oh, the Simpsons did explain it. I haven't seen that.
Yeah, they apparently their Treehouse of Horror episode or just before this year, they kind of go through this whole thing that Homer's been in a coma since he went off the cliff.
And Jesus
all
Christ.
Sorts of things. Yeah, it's really weird. That. Yeah, properly right. they've got, and it apparently explains how they can tell the future as well.
I'm going to have to track that one down.
Yeah,
that's nice little fox aside, that is cool. But so we'll have to work on that basis for this. Maybe it all turns out it was a coma in Omen 4. if you put that to one side, you can just watch the films as they are. And my first thought on this film was it very much felt like a sort of early Final Destination.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, it's definitely got a feeling of those 90s era. You could even throw in at times, it has a bit of Smallville about it. It really does feel like that sort of high school set period where we got all that stuff like One Tree Hill as well. Definitely with the horror era element thrown in.
Yeah, it's an interesting sort of setting to put most of it in into that military school.
Yeah,
but I'm probably going to pick up on the cast a bit. For me, one of the weak parts of the film actually is him.
Yeah.
And I noticed he hadn't got much of a filmography after. He seemed to disappear at the back end of the 80s. Yeah. So.
Yeah, that's kind of my one negative note about this film is that the actor for Damien is so wooden. Mm. Don't get me wrong. In fairness, quite a couple of the child actors in this are very wooden. But yeah, I think that's the risk that you run with child actors.
Yeah, the lad playing his cousin isn't particularly scintillating either, is he?
No.
One note I've got on actor-wise, we get an uncredited cameo of Ron Paul of the Bay Leg.
Well, that's Leo was... he's not credited, yeah. I don't think.
Yeah.
He repeats that part.
Yeah.
Early on, but... That's quite horrific, the way those two guys sort of get sort of snuffed out in the sand, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, very unexpected, but it also feels like the Exorcist prequel as well.
Yes, and actually, well, the start of the Exorcist as well is set, of course, out in Iran, I think, or something like that.
Yeah.
And it's got that same sort of vibe.
Yeah.
There's all the markings. For me, that's another way. We're going to be jumping around here a bit, and I think one of the things that jumps out at me from that is, I did like that bit where they use the paintings, where we see the younger version of him one.
Yeah.
Where they find it, and then we see the older version later on. I thought that was a nice touch in this film to have that bit in there.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like the painting itself ages with Damien because it is a picture of a deity.
Because the other thing on the cast as well, I think is William Holden, I think, was up for the part in the first film. I'm sure I read that somewhere that he was one of those that they considered for the part that Beck got in the first film. So whether they went back to him, they said, well, you didn't get it the first time around. How about you play his brother?
Yeah, it's second best, so you can play like the second brother.
Yeah. But it's a strange film in some ways because it almost feels like it hits some of the same beats, doesn't it? Because we get the knife turn up again at the end as well. And that's actually quite shocking, that scene that they use those in. But I wanted to sort of just dwell on a little bit on we mentioned briefly the deaths. There are some really inventive ones in this one.
Yeah. The one I've got a note is the doctor.
Oh, yes, in the lift, yes.
Yeah, I only watched this film this morning, the morning that we're recording this now. And as I do with any films that we watch, but honestly, I must have been watching this at about 7:30 this morning, and when he gets fucking cut in half by a big piece of bloody cable, and honest to God, I nearly screamed and woke the house up because that shocked the shit out of me.
It is brutal, isn't it?
You do think the second he presses the lift button, you think, right, okay, so the lift's going to either go all the way up to where he's supposed to be going and then just go bang right down, or he's just going to get in the lift and it'll just drop. No, you do not expect that cable to come crashing out of nowhere till you see it.
Yeah.
That was fantastic.
Really gory. And then they seem to have ramped up, we're still not into 80s cinema yet, but they seem to have ramped up the gore in this one as well.
Yeah.
The journalist out on the road as well. That is absolutely brutal. When she basically has got no eyes in the one scene, and it just freaks me out just thinking about it.
Yeah, and the American football stuff as well. That was never going to end well, was it?
The ice hockey.
Yeah.
Yeah. When they're the guy on the.
In fairness, though, that ice hockey bit caught me off guard because I thought. When Bugenhagen was explaining he'll kill all the extended family so that the business becomes his, and I thought, right, so there's the cousin who's obviously going to inherit everything, so he'll get him killed off first. And when they're playing ice hockey, I thought, right, here goes the brother for a bit and threw a big hole in the ice or something. No, it's the fella. And I thought, the little Al fell, and I thought, oh, that's right, Dad. He wasn't actually going to do anything.
And, he was just in the way, basically, of Robert Foxworth's character, basically having that VP position or whatever it was.
And speaking of which, that's something that really surprised me was the level of, I don't know if you call them demons in this franchise or anything, but...
Well, I don't call them acolytes.
Acolytes, yeah. The level of acolytes that they had and the amount of them, because in the first one, you only actually had the priests who get killed off at the start when he's born, and then the nanny. That's it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whereas this, you've got one in the
you've got Lansdowne Richardson in the academy.
Yeah, you've got the academy fella, you've got the business fella, and to and completely wife, spoil it, the wife, yeah. And I'm not being funny.
That's a real shock twist.
Yeah.
The first time I watched it, when she says to him, "I was always his," and just sticks those knives in it. Bloody hell.
Well, when she stuck him with the knife, I thought, oh, she's actually protecting him, but doesn't realize that it's true that he's the Antichrist. But then, as you say, she comes out with that line, and I went, fucking hell, I did not see that coming.
Yeah. I mean, I swear when you look back at it, the fact that you do sort of wonder what happened to the Mark's, was it Mark's cousin, the birth mother?
Yeah, Mark's mum, yeah.
Cousin, whether she was gotten rid of somewhere, and that's why he ended up with a stepmum.
Yeah.
And a second wife for the...
Well, the second wife's death is very grim.
And then, yes, Damon just... Yeah, he doesn't even care about his followers, does he? Just to do that and torture them up.
Means to an end.
Yeah, he's an absolute shit.
But what sort of got me a bit weird about this film, I actually really enjoy this film, just say that outright. It's not as good as the first, but it is a good watch. But the thing that weirded me out was, in the first one, you always felt like the child knew who he was, but chose to act like a 5 and 6 year old kid. Whereas in this, you get the sense that actor has absolutely no fucking clue that Damien is the Antichrist until he just randomly reads chapter 13 of the Book of Revelations. And then just runs to Doc and screams why and runs back and goes, yeah, I'm fine with this now. I'll just go and kill every fucker who's in my way.
Yeah, it's almost like he's just forgotten over the last 7 years, isn't it?
Yeah.
And one of my final notes was, for most of it, he just comes across as a spoiled brat that just kills when he doesn't get his own way.
Yeah. Yeah, because there's a couple of weird, because there's the guy that goes off, I can't remember the scientist's name, the one who developed the machine that they're testing. And it all goes just gas everywhere. And it just seems such a random one for him, because he's not really in anybody's way.
Well, and not only that, he's developing the device that Damien presumably, I don't know what happens in the third one, but Damien will presumably use to control the world's food supply.
I mean, the only bit that even remotely was in the way for him was that he'd mentioned the fact that he was going to bring up the fact that those people had been killed, didn't they, that were out in but it for me, that was the really weird one in terms of the plot. It didn't make any sense. It just felt like it was just Damien being a twat actually killing somebody who wasn't really in his way.
I mean, that's a nice way of putting it about the Antichrist.
But the other one I thought was a bit weird when you talk about these characters and those two acolytes is they share the odd look, but they never really have a scene where they sort of acknowledge each other or talk about the situation.
Yeah, but you know what? I really like that. And I'll tell you why. I like it because it's as if, and in my sort of personal head canon of this franchise, although they are called acolytes, to me, they are the demons from hell that inhabit the souls of the bodies of dead people. And they can just communicate. They just know what each other are thinking instinctively, so they don't need to say anything. And to me, that makes it more sinister.
And I like to see, I think it's one of the earliest things I saw Lance Henriksen in, actually, that and the Terminator. This came out 78, I think.
Yeah, 78, yeah.
And I didn't even realise it was him to start with.
No.
It took me a while to twig that was who it was. I'd seen his name in the cast list.
Yeah.
But it didn't even equate that it was him to start with. It
must be one of his earliest roles, because, I mean, I think of intended from sort of Terminator onwards as being in stuff. Terminator Near Dark, and those are all sort of 83, 84-ish, 85. So this was like 6, 7, 8 years before that. So he's been around for a while.
His first job was 1961, but then he didn't work again for another 11 years.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
So I don't know whether he was in the armed forces. He might well have been for that amount of time.
Yeah, could have been doing the national service or something.
Yeah, and then he was doing bits and pieces. He had a few uncredited things. And then his first real big job was Close Encounters.
Yeah, which was 79-ish?
77. So it was just before this.
Yeah.
So that was it. It was those two were his first two big jobs.
It would have been that and Close Encounters are the first thing I probably saw. Yeah. That's funny. And then he kind of, you don't see him in anything for a couple of years. Then he pops up in the detective in the Terminator.
Yeah.
And Robert Foxworth, I know from, I think he was in a soap opera on the telly, maybe. Was he in Falcon Crest or something when I was a kid? I know him from television. That's where I was more familiar with him, from something. But somebody else who popped up in a lot of stuff.
The only actor I could have picked out of this cast, out of a lineup, like saying I know them from something else, was the sergeant in the academy from Alien. Everyone else, and was like, that's the first thing I've seen them in.
And you were right, Tony, he was in Falcon Crest.
That's right, yeah, I thought it was.
Jesus Christ, Tony, you need to get on Mastermind, kid.
Oh, yeah, I say that I'd absolutely shit myself and just freeze if I ever had a quiz show. I wouldn't even consider Popmaster or Radio 2. I know so little about music. The other character we should mention that really, really annoys me is that fucking crow. He's just everywhere, isn't he? Nasty piece of work, especially scene on the road.
It is like a proper... Well, it's the name of the franchise, technically, isn't it?
Yeah.
It is the Omen.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's just the one on the road there. Like, he does all the damage and he goes, fucks off to the trees to watch the crash. And you bastard.
I know, the sadistic little bastard.
Yeah.
Although I will say about that death scene, it is obviously really horrible to watch her get her eyes pecked out and whatever, but you've got to admit, when that truck comes along, someone's definitely just thrown a mannequin at that truck.
Yeah.
From off camera.
But the whole sequence is really well shot, because I did notice, because there's a long shot with the truck and you can actually see, well, her, I say, the character in the red coat further down the road, so there's all that, the attention to detail in the sequence is really good. You could easily just have shot that with a lorry, but because it's a quick cut, but you can actually just see in the distance the red figure on the road that's just about to step out. And the whole sequence is really well put together, actually, I think. The dummy aside. the other one's particularly nasty, I think, is I can't remember the character's name, but her friend from the museum and that. The
train Charles. Truck.
Yeah, is it Charles?
Yeah, Charles.
Yeah, Charles is Charles Yeo, and he's an absolute mess when we see him in that end sequence. But his demise is nasty as well.
Well, the thing is, it's a thing that I've said a lot across like our reviews of certain films when like massive deaths have occurred. It's one of them where you don't actually see what has taken place to kill them, so you conjure the picture in your mind, and that's worse than anything they could put on screen.
Yeah, I suspect there's not a lot left of his top half in that sequence.
Yeah, literally, yeah. although I will say about this film in general, and it's just kind of reminded me, considering the sort of role that Charles plays in this film, that it does actually reuse a lot of the plot points and motifs from the first film.
It just
sort of reorders them and gives them to different characters to do. It works. Don't get me wrong; it really works, but it is quite noticeable if you pay attention.
The death of Mark is really harsh as well. She got a soul. He didn't want to be involved with him, and the way he just sort of does that to him basically gives him like an embolism, doesn't he? Practically,
yeah. I mean, and it's the fact that when it's his funeral, you hear the doctor in the background explaining how he's died. Mm. And it because of the thing that Damien is able to do to him right there on the spot, it's something yeah. that could happen to someone at birth and not happen till they are yeah. X amount of years down the line in their life.
Yeah. Yeah. Any other significant things you guys want to pull out of the film? Anything that sort of stands out for you?
I've got a couple of bits that I wanted to bring up because yep. Unlike Josh, I'm not as big a fan of this one as I was the first. I think this is a significant drop in quality.
Yeah, it's not as good, but I do think it is a fairly decent watch. I would go and watch it again if I was doing a rewatch of the entire franchise.
But yeah, I've just got a couple of things I'd like to bring up. I felt this lacked the religious edge of the first film. It was very much implied throughout that there was this religious thing. There was a lot of church scenes. Obviously, the priest throughout it, and just stuff like that. And I felt this one was really lacking in that.
And the bits of that we did get, like from the journalist woman, they basically just feel like they're retelling the bits we already know, aren't they? From the
yeah.
first one.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And my other big issue with it was the setting. The locations of the first one really played into, and we talked about this when we watched the remake, that lacked it as well. Yeah. And for the most part, this did, with it being set where it was. And it had this weird, like, undercurrent of business issues.
Yeah.
Throughout, yeah, which I just thought was really strange.
But they do sort of say that it's kind of just veering into the politics a bit that will come up in the third film, basically, isn't it?
Yeah.
And Warner tells us in the first film that they'll be sort of rising in the sort of sea of politics. And this is just an aside to that, isn't it?
Yeah.
The lines between business and politics are very, very blurred, aren't they, I suppose?
Yeah, yeah. My other thing that I was going to bring up, the protector of him this time, going from the thing, the mad dog that we had in the first one,
yeah.
to a tiny little crow in this one.
The crow.
Yeah.
It's not really imposing, is it?
No.
Although, as we've just mentioned, it's a nasty little bastard, though.
Yeah, it is. But it's just, I just thought it was a little bit strange that they went from this big hairy beast to a tiny little thing.
Although, when he killed the ant, that old sequence where it's in like the bedroom, my first thought was that episode was The Simpsons Treehouse of Horror.
Which is one of my favourite episodes of The Simpsons, the Edgar Allan Poe episode, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. The Raven, I should say.
Not yeah.
The Raven. Eat my shorts. And it's actually one of my favourites as well. That's the very first episode, I think, of those that they did.
Yeah.
I went to that place when I was watching that, because it's like, basically, the crow just gives her a heart attack by staring at her.
Well, yeah, to be honest, to jump onto that, I get what you mean, Paul, because if it's the fact that there was the bit in the hospital where the doctor starts querying that Damien is different, and he looks at his blood, and it's dog's blood.
Yeah.
So it would have made sense that he still has that hellhound at his side at all times. Mm. And then basically, rather than the crow just fucking flying in, giving her the stare of death, it'd be better if the dog had come in the middle of the night and mauled her.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. I suppose it's just very much the case with sequels. They try and change things up a little bit, don't they? It's like something, you know, what can we use that's quite menacing, like a black dog? A black bird.
Yeah.
Thank God it wasn't a black hamster. A raven.
Of course, ravens and crows, they are sort of prophets of doom, aren't they? I think, or something like that. There's an iconography about them, isn't there?
Yeah, which is fair enough. It feels like it's a step back. Like you could have started with the crow in the first one.
Yeah.
And then this one took the step to it being the dog as he becomes stronger.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, I get that. Yeah. Josh, any other else to strike for you in the film?
Other than I really, really enjoyed it. it's not as good as the first, but it's a fairly decent attempt at trying to make it a sequel that's better than the first. They don't do it, but it's a good attempt. I'm just wondering whether I might end up rewatching this a couple months down the line and going, yeah, do you know what? Whatever score I gave for that recording, that I need to change that somehow. Because I've got a fairly decent score for it, but it's not brilliant.
No, it's just about my score is probably similar to yourself. I mean, we could think about sort of just kind of overall thoughts, and I suppose I'll kick off. Yes, for me, I mean, I think I probably watched it for the first time on the telly, like very much like you did a lot of these, and remember at the time just thinking that it's not quite as tense and as gripping as the first one. Like Paul says, the locations aren't so interesting in this one because it's not set in Britain. It's like American Midwest, isn't it? I think American Eastern Seaboard.
It lacks the English side of stuff, and it also lacks the Rome stuff for me as well.
Yeah, so it's not even in quote unquote exotic parts of the States, really, is it? It's that cold, dank sort of northeastern seaboard area, and it's just a bit like here in the winter. But I can say that they ramp up the sort of death quota in this a bit, don't the quotient and the gore, I think, over the first one.
Definitely.
There are some invented deaths. I mean, like the ante is quite pretty bog standard. Oh, let's pretend the devil make out like she's had an heart attack, just because that. The ice sequence one I think is fantastic. It's absolutely cruel on that old boy that he goes like that. The one Josh mentioned, the lift, is just superb. The VFX around him for the lift aren't quite so good. They're very 70s and 80s. Back projection. But other than that, I think the old sequence itself is great, and they keep sort of cutting to the cable.
Jerry back is in it as well.
Yeah, Jerry's back, of course, for the score, which is always good. Probably not a standout, or as emphatic as he scored for the first one. It just gets lost a little bit, I think, in the film in general. But it's for me, it's a passable sequel. The biggest problem with it for me is the lead actor. Doesn't really have this, like you say, he comes across as more petulant than really demonic in most of the film. And score-wise, I mean, I think I put the first one in the 90s. I think that's a real classic for me. This one probably drops below 80. I'm going to probably, I'd say, about 77%. It's okay, but it's not The Omen, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah, you guys, any final thoughts, scores?
I'm nowhere near that. I just found it a really poorly executed sequel. Boring in comparison, lacks any of the religious power of the original, and he just comes across as a bit of a sport brat who kills when he doesn't get his own way. I gave it a 62.
Interesting. Which is less than my remake score.
there's not really much further I can add other than what I've already said. Thinking about what you've added on, Paul, with the religious stuff, I never even gave that a second thought, but thinking about it now, my original score coming into this was roughly around the same as Tony's, give or take one or two marks. But now that you've said that, I it's really playing on my mind that they didn't have all that religious stuff added into it, except for the very start bit. So, to be honest, mine's now dropped to around the 70 dead on mark.
It's fair enough. Yeah. I mean, I kind of score it. Yeah, I think you have to try. I think depending on how you treat it as well. I kind of view it myself as almost like as a proto slasher film, like I say, like a Final Destination film, as a religious sequel to the first one. Like Paul says, it falls a bit flat in that respect. And it was just a case of what can we do bigger in this one? Let's do the deaths a bit bigger. Right, well, that's going to be interesting to see what you guys think of the third part then when we do that next month, which is The Omen 3, starring, of course, Sam Neill. Thank you, gents, for joining me for this second part.
No worries.
It's confusing when we've done a remake as well. it's the second part of the trilogy, but the third part of the ones that we're doing. And we'll see you all again next month.